Hey everyone, and welcome to this Risky Business Soapbox edition. My name's Patrick Gray. The Soapbox podcast series is a wholly sponsored podcast we do here at risky.bizhq. Vendors do pay to participate, and this Soapbox edition is brought to you by Attack IQ. Attack IQ is a five-year-old company that makes an attack simulation platform. The idea is you agitate a network with suspicious traffic and activities, then you measure what the response looks like on the other side of your security controls. As you'll hear, Stefan argues, you know, as Stefan quite reasonably argues, this is a better way to test your controls than trying to do it either during or after an incident has occurred. Now, mostly people are using this technology to verify the effectiveness of their security controls. They already have endpoint security software. They have IDS, various monitoring bits and pieces, maybe even some DLP. But quite often these controls just aren't tuned right. So, you know, you throw some attack traffic and behavior at your systems and you see what bubbles up and you see if your analysts catch it. That's an important piece as well. Now, one piece of work that has been absolutely vital to Attack IQ's success is the MITRE Attack Matrix. Like Attack IQ, the Attack Matrix has been around for about 5 years, and the idea behind it is it's like a matrix of attack behaviors or events triggered by attacks, I guess. So the idea is, like, once you start crossing off behaviors on the matrix for an observed attack, you've sort of got a bit of a blueprint for it. And you can then start looking at controls that mitigate those behaviors or events. I'm not sure that I'm explaining this particularly well, but I'm guessing many of you will be familiar with the matrix. If you're not, I've linked through to the matrix itself in the show notes for this podcast, so you can have a look at it there as well. Anyway, Stefan Chenette is Attack IQ's CTO, and he joined me to talk about how they're trying to use the attack matrix to drive their whole outlook. You know, they're really gearing their products to be very attack matrix friendly. And conversely, they're also spending time talking to MITRE about where the whole thing is going and even throwing some ideas in that direction as well. So, look, Stefan and I, we spoke about how firewall misconfigurations are still embarrassingly common. We talked about, you know, how you do attack simulation when you're dealing with ephemeral assets. And we spoke about a bunch more stuff as well. So here's Stefan Chenette kicking things off by talking a bit about how Attack IQ's outlook has evolved over the years. Here he is.
Initially, we were testing security technology stacks. So think of cloud, DLP, you know, AWS, Google Cloud Controls. We've mentioned EDR several times. So we were focused on the technology. And many of our customers started bringing us other use cases, like testing kind of the SecDevOps, DevSecOps stack, you know, this whole CI/CD kind of framework. As an app is deployed into the infrastructure, how do you validate that the security baseline is still what's expected and within it? And so
how do you make sure your monitoring is standing up when what you're monitoring has changed?
Yeah, and the whole stack has changed in terms of operations, right? And so it's changing every minute. As soon as, you know, a developer makes a change, it gets deployed. How is security staying up with that? And so Attack IQ started introducing use cases in order to go and validate on the fly as soon as an application is being deployed into the infrastructure, the same security baseline. So that was something that we've learned from customers that was needed. And that's just the evolution of where we are from IT and operations. And then testing the security operations center skill set. You know, there's a ton of organizations that are bringing on junior, mid-level SOC operators and trying to train them up. And if you're a SOC operator, that's what you want yourself. You want to get better at your craft and your trade and understanding anomalies and understanding the technologies within your infrastructure. And you need the time in order to do it versus only being tested when there's an attacker inside of your network. And so Attack IQ's platform really started introducing the ability to run scenarios from a training perspective.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you first started out, as you pointed out, it was like, is our EDR deployed correctly? You know, is our SOC, are the right alerts bubbling up into SOC consoles? It sounds like now more and more what you're doing is process validation.
Yeah, I mean, processes are all between, you know, elements within that security stack. So if you've got a particular solution, is that solution, you know, communicating correctly to your SIM? And then is that SIM communicating correctly to your orchestration engine? And so, you know, as that progresses and more organizations have more automated security stacks, it needs to be validated in that automated fashion.
So look, let's just go back to the DevSecOps component there, because I find that interesting, right? Because what you're talking about, I mean, you don't do detection. What you're looking at doing is figuring out if detection is working. So when someone deploys a new app or a new app component or makes a change to an app, how does attack simulation actually tell you when you're dealing with something new, whether or not your controls are still functioning in terms of covering off attacks against that new thing? Like, walk us through that use case, because I find that one pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that's where MITRE's attack matrix has really changed the entire game. So, you know, in the evolution of attack IQ, you know, first we were working quite closely with the operators, and then we became to the stage where we worked more and more with the executive team. They wanted to map to a framework. So they have a defensive strategy, they have hundreds of security tools that are rampant within their infrastructure. So developer comes, deploys a new application, and there's supposed to be controls within that application detecting or preventing any malicious behavior. How does that executive team measure all of those security controls, and how are those metrics mapped to a framework that matters? And there's, you know, there's NIST, but what ended up happening is MITRE's attack matrix has really become the framework of choice by a lot of different organizations and executives to map what are attacker behaviors, map to what are the controls in place, and how to test that to understand the baseline.
So I guess from your perspective is you just keep attacking or sending, you know, attack traffic towards, simulated attack traffic towards that application. And what you're looking for is to make sure that that's still bubbling up in the background there and coming through okay. Is that sort of, have I got it there?
Yeah, I mean, what we'll do is we'll have our platform send a number of very relevant scenarios against the particular security controls that have been selected by our customers. And at the same time, we have dozens of integrations that will hook directly into the aggregation logging mechanisms in order to determine and measure the detection and prevention ability. So it's a constant catch and release. You know, we're aggregating the network, agitating the network and agitating the host and all those controls, and then measuring that at the same time.
And I guess what you're doing is you're making sure that a developer hasn't inadvertently broken that process by reducing visibility of some of these, reducing the visibility of some of these security tools into what's going on.
Oh, 100%. And it's, now it's not only the responsibility of the security team. What we've done is also give the power back to the developer, who, as soon as they deploy an application, themselves can actually test the security controls around the infrastructure, which in many cases they're responsible for.
So they can kick off the simulations themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Now, look, you know, the attack, as I'm sure is abundantly clear to our listeners at this point, the MITRE attack framework is essentially your Bible, right? Like, that is the document from which all flows. I'm curious, though, whether or not you have found any deficiencies in that framework, or do you think it really is just they've just nailed it?
No, there's definitely deficiencies. And, you know, we're working with Blake over at on the MITRE attack team and a lot of the members there. Where we see a lot of deficiencies is more in the mapping. So if we're looking at the, you know, the critical controls, whether you're looking at, you know, mapping that to the various tactics within the post-attack techniques, there's deficiencies. You can't map completely into all the controls. And I think that's something that within time will be corrected.
Because now you're speaking about this like from the perspective of someone who lives, breathes, eats, and drinks the MITRE attack framework. So I want you to back it up a little bit there. And you're like, oh yeah, there's problems with the mapping. And I'd like you to, you know, back it up there and try to give us, you know, not a layman's description, but what are you talking about when you say that there's problems with the mapping?
Yeah. So when you look at the critical security controls, you know, when you're looking at, you know, inventory of authorized and unauthorized devices, right, CSC1, and inventory of authorized and unauthorized software, CSC2, and you're trying to map that to the various tactics and the techniques, because all of these are frameworks, whether we're looking at really the NIST cybersecurity framework, whether we're looking at the critical security controls, whether we're looking at, you know, the kill chain, all of these are frameworks that within your organization, you might have adapted your defensive strategies and your decisions to. And MITRE's attack matrix is really something that both on the vendor side and from the perspective of the organization is being adapted. And so you want to have something that is flexible enough to map to all of your frameworks. And so where we see deficiencies is you want to be able to map all of these frameworks to each other. And so now these frameworks are starting to become aware of each other, acknowledging each other, and talking so that there's a better mapping towards all of the various sections.
So what sort of updates can we expect to see in the attack matrix itself, do you think? Look into the crystal ball and predict it.
Yeah, I think that I remember when, you know, Lockheed Martin had their kill chain, which, say what you will, but they focused very much on the pre-attack stage, right? And really the strength of MITRE's attack matrix was it focused on something that mattered, I think, more, which was the fact that we all knew as an organization you'd be compromised at some point. So MITRE's attack matrix focused on the post-exploitation and the post-attack. So one of the updates that they've made recently was to introduce tactics for pre-attack. And so that made it easy to map to Lockheed Martin's kill chain if that's something that your organization adapted to. And they've done a great job. And that's something that continues in its evolution of adding more techniques and more tactics to.
Okay. So, you know, earlier we were talking about use cases. The use cases are always changing. Can you think of another one that that makes for good conversation?
Well, I think most of the time, you and I were talking right before the podcast about, you know, some of my travel schedule, and I was in New York last week talking to an energy and utilities kind of sector of leaders. And so energy and utility right now is really trying to put their best foot forward and trying to come up to the modern age of automating a lot of the patching or updates. And they're looking at automation, right? And they're not
They're almost a perfect candidate to do this stuff properly because they're so far behind. It's almost greenfields. Yeah.
A lot of times energy and utilities, the control that they're thinking of is air gapped, right? And so validating what is air gapped and is not, as opposed to just assuming that. But, you know, once you get past that particular control and you actually look at the technology controls that they've put in place, then they actually want to start validating. And so this is a concept that we presented to them. And, you know, MITRE's attack matrix is still new to a lot of the industries that we talk to. It's much more heavily used in finance and in tech right now, but a lot of the other industries are becoming aware of it and starting to use it when they're thinking of, well, what defensive software security control should I put in next and start prioritizing, they can start looking at the gaps they have in the MITRE attack matrix.
I mean, that's what makes it such a valuable document, right? And such a valuable framework is it really is a roadmap to, and it doesn't tell you how to do it. It just tells you what needs to be done and why. But, you know, it is interesting that you mentioned that it's more popular in some verticals. I mean, finance, no surprise there, you know, finance and banking. But where else, and tech, of course, but where else does it pop up? Like, where are the verticals which are the verticals that you see are really, you know, sort of adopting this approach?
Well, of course, you're going to see them in the more heavily regulated industries. Healthcare is a good example. And, you know, one of the things about MITRE's attack matrix, you know, it's not necessarily prescriptive, it's more descriptive, right? And
yeah.
So in our kind of evolution of Attack IQ's platform, what we've done is we've tried to visualize that matrix as much as possible. So if you log into our platform, you'll see the whole matrix across all the tactics and actually be able to click into one of the boxes of the tactics mixed with the techniques and then just try all the techniques against your controls right there and then. And it creates this extremely valuable and obvious heat map of what's a gap and where the strengths are in the organization.
I can imagine how satisfying it must have been when you got that bit working, you know, from an interface perspective. Like,
You know, as much cool tech as we have beneath the cover, when you see something visualized and then you go and show it off in a demo and then, you know, whether it's a prospect or a customer and whatever industry, and you see their eyes light up, it's really satisfying. You know, and you go back to the team and everybody's excited about it because it's a lot of hard work to take something extremely technical and try to abstract it to a level that anyone should be able to understand and anyone should be able to really run behind the scenes.
Okay, here's a question for you. Which parts of the attack framework are the most difficult to validate?
So when the easiest parts of the framework are typically kind of network controls. And the more difficult are anything having to do with kind of the host space. And the reason for that is, you know, we have a do no harm policy, right? Whenever we're looking at the scenarios that we want to codify and implement within the MITRE attack matrix, we want to make sure that we're not doing any harm to the network, because we run our scenarios on critical systems of the business. And so anything having to do with network typically is not going to have any detrimental effect to the business. And we have to be very careful when we're talking about some of the host-based scenarios of memory injection. We try to stay away from exploitation as much as possible. So network is much easier than anything having to do with lower level techniques, especially if you get into kind of the boot sector type scenarios.
Yeah, you don't want to really be overriding that just to see what's going to happen, right? Like that's the issue. Can we detect if the boot sector is overwritten? You need to be able to validate that control without actually doing it. I mean, is there a way around that? Like, can you set up like a handful of like mule systems on the network that just exist for simulation purposes, or does that kind of defeat the point of the exercise?
No, I mean, and that's exactly what our customers do. So, you know, one of the huge differences with AttackIQ and the rest of the players in the space is that we're an open platform. So that doesn't mean that we're open source, but that allows our customers to basically integrate with their solutions very easily, but also create any scenario that is going to help them validate their concerns and their assumptions, including some of those low-level scenarios. So then they can select assets that are less critical, or as you said, they can put a bunch of virtual machines on the network and load that, you know, VM with the host-based security software, and then go to town with a scenario that would be typically much more
destructive,
on a production machine.
Now, you know, you just mentioned that it's an open platform and that you've got customers constructing scenarios. Some time ago, we spoke about this, and I know for you, an objective, like something that you really wanted to do, was build a community around this stuff. How is that going, honestly? Because building communities where people share things like that, it sounds easy, but it's not. Like, how's it gone, honestly?
Yeah, I mean, a community takes time. So we have a few hundred contributors inside of our community, but what it ends up being is very key individuals within our customer base, within our consultancy.
Yeah, you wind up with like 500 registered and like five people who are really contributing valuable stuff. Is that sort of where you've wound up at this point?
Yeah, I mean, contributions come in many forms. Some are actually codifying the scenarios, and then you've got the other hundreds using those scenarios and then providing feedback back to the core contributors that are more programmers.
Yeah, yeah. So more like forum threads saying, "Yeah, I used this one. It was great. Thanks. Cheers." But this thing was this thing was weird. Maybe you want to fix that. I mean, that's the thing.
But sometimes,
right?
that's extremely valuable. I mean, so we'll have.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Scenario developers that are more versed in the cloud, you know, security space, some that are more versed in particular industry specific type of attacks or concerns. And then you have a huge audience that goes off and runs these certain attacks and then comes back with feedback on how to improve testing and validation.
I mean, we should point out at this point, because for some people, this might be the first time they've ever heard about AttackIQ, that you know, this is an attack simulation platform that allows people to essentially script scenarios, and you've got hundreds, don't you?
Yeah, no, we have thousands at this point, and the concept behind it is so that at the end of the day, you're making data-driven decisions within your security organization. You have hundreds of security controls. If you aren't testing them, if you're not validating, you're simply assuming that they're working. And what we found is in most cases, they're misconfigured. So you have to continuously test them.
And I think that comes as a surprise to nobody that most security equipment is misconfigured because it's just a little bit too flexible most of the time. But that's a conversation for another day. What are the types of scenarios that have proven to be the most popular? I mean, you must be able to track that somehow.
So a lot of times it actually comes down to anecdotal scenarios, right? So when we're looking at the timeliness of various scenarios, what's actually happened within, you know, the news and the security team, whether it's the SOC or the CISO or the CIO or the DevOps team comes to AttackIQ, and we have a mapping structure that maps to MITRE's attack matrix to make it very easy to find that. And we have a tagging mechanism to easily find very relevant scenarios. But the more interesting scenarios are those that are as relevant as possible to that organization and something that's a concern. So we'll map to attacker names. And, you know, MITRE ATT&CK doesn't only have their own ID schema, but they actually will correlate back to known names within what CrowdStrike, as an example, might be using, or others as a known entity for those attacker groups.
So it really depends on the organization.
Yeah, it really does. And in many cases, it's not just it's about the flavor of the month for scenarios. From AttackIQ's perspective, we look at patterns. And so whether it's a piece of ransomware or some piece of an attack or malware that's doing something, we've most likely seen that before. And so the scenario is going to capture the pattern. So when someone comes and it's like, well, do you have X and Y and Z scenario of an attack that happened last week? We go back and look at the patterns of scenarios, and more than likely we have such
a scenario. That's interesting. So you're taking stuff that's popped up in the wild, sort of reverse engineering what it looks like from a MITRE attack framework perspective, and then writing a play for that, like writing a script for that.
Yeah, and that's really the goal, because that was...
Because that's cool, because you speak to a lot of... I speak to a lot of CISOs, and something big will happen in the news, like the Equifax breach, and they might want to... be able to plug in a scenario. What would that attack look like? Would we see that attack against us or a similar attack to that?
Exactly. And we hear more in the news about the pre-attack phase, how they got in, what vulnerability was taken advantage of. But we rarely hear, because of legal reasons, what happens after an attack, when they got in, what did they take advantage of, how did they move around the network, how did they create some destruction, how did they get data out? And so being able to look at the most common patterns is extremely valuable for an organization, because you have to assume an attacker will get in, and are you prepared? And so now that you're easily able to test and validate that with or platform, you can actually have those answers.
Now, some time ago, we spoke about how EDR tends to be the most commonly misconfigured security control. Given that it's one of the most configurable security controls, I don't necessarily think that's surprising. But I'd imagine that, you'd be in a position now to have some ideas around which controls are actually most effective and which ones are easiest to validate. What are they?
Well, it's no surprise that a lot of the main types of security technologies are EDR, are EPP, are IDS, IPS, DLP, web filtering, firewalls. And so these are the primary security controls we'll look at. And whether it's an operator who had to make a change over the weekend and didn't change it back, I mean, how many times have we heard that? These are the types of misconfigurations that we're talking about. Or not electing to choose something that's not on by default that would prevent a critical type of...
I guess really, actually, Stefan, what you're getting at here is the easiest security wins are in actually configuring what you have correctly in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I remember... Okay, so like a bit of a tangent here, but... a long time ago, and I mean in the very early days of Risky Business, when it was mostly just listened to by, say, 1,000 people in Australia who worked in enterprise, I had a firewall company book time in the show as a sponsor. And back then, of course, it was very, very cheap, right? It was like basically beer money for them to sponsor this program. And the reason they did that was because so many of their customers, and this was, as I said, a firewall company, the reason they did this is so many of their customers were adding allow any rules to the firewalls that they sold and then not changing them back. So something would break, they'd allow any and then just forget about it. So basically once a month, a guy from this firewall company would come onto the show and just sort of remind people to have a look at their rules and make sure that allow any, wasn't a thing, right? Is this still a problem?
Yeah, I mean... firewall configurations are still a problem, and it's an age old problem. But we have to move past the manual analysis. I mean, everything's moving towards automation. Everything's moving. I mean, nowadays
people have too many firewalls now to be able to actually just go in and check their rule sets for that. But it's kind of depressing that you actually need an attack simulation platform to verify your firewall controls. God.
I mean, you need a validation platform to now validate your hundreds of security controls. So there's that many more security controls to validate that are on top of that firewall.
No, it's just crazy, right? And I remember, when Palo Alto Networks really did an amazing job. Like there's a reason they're rolling around in giant piles of money, because they came out of nowhere because of that problem, right? They sort of came up with a firewall that was a little bit easier to configure, and it was more pointy clicky, and you didn't sort of wind up with those sorts of problems. Are there breeds of networking kit and firewall kit that are less prone to being misconfigured? Because I would have thought, the next generation stuff, gag, right, next generation, but I would have thought that stuff is a little bit harder to fuck up.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a really interesting point, and it might be that the most secure types of security technologies for the future are the types of security technologies that are the easiest to configure so that you don't f*** them up. Yeah. I mean, that's really what we're looking at.
Yeah, and have you found, I mean, you're always reluctant to name and shame or name and praise, right? Like, I get that. But is there a clear distinction between some of these like firewall vendors?
Yeah, and there's not going to be a surprise as to some of the larger names that have done a good job and put a lot of attention to the user experience and making sure, as we've gotten a lot of new junior and mid-level SOC analysts to the mix of teams, that the actual technology is easy to use and is you know not going to be misconfigured that easily. But it's
so
still
you mean
happens.
Not Cisco.
I mean, there's a lot of different technologies.
Ah, come on, come on. Say it. Just say it. Yeah, we know you're thinking it.
I mean, obviously, the more sophisticated and complex type technologies are going to be easier to misconfigure because they're that much more complex, right?
Yeah.
And I at the end of the day, I really am, you know, not... I look at every single security technology, and if it's got more features, it's going to have more configurations and more chances to be misconfigured. And again, that's why when we started AttackIQ, you know, 5 years ago, and at first everyone was very reluctant. It's like, well, why do we need to validate our security controls? And then it became much more obvious
as we had because they don't work. More,
they haven't been configured correctly. You actually don't know that 50% of your organization hasn't deployed them to the endpoint at all, if not even, you know, correctly. And so having that visibility now allows you to make better decisions. And at the end of the day, if you don't have that visibility, you're not going to be making, you know, smart decisions for the org. You're going to be, you know, wrongly prioritizing your projects, and you just got to be making smarter decisions. And you can't do that if you don't have the visibility.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. You know that.
Yeah.
you know that. But I guess, you know, too, I'm wondering like some wrong, you know, I want to know what wrong turns you've taken, AttackIQ, in terms of perhaps in earlier times, you know, flagging things as being misconfigured when they weren't. Like what are some of the things you've learned about doing attack simulation? What are some of the mistakes that you made earlier on with this?
Well, so it's less about false positives because, again, we don't offer prescriptive, you know, solutions in many cases. It's more descriptive based off best practices. So at the end of the day, you run a scenario, and if something's incorrectly configured, we're going to offer, in most cases, a descriptive solution for it. And we offer our customers the ability to come in and customize that and offer something more prescriptive. But I think early on, some of the big mistakes that we made was, you know, I had come from the consulting world and I tried to output a lot of our reports exactly as a security assessment from a generalized approach would, as opposed to mapping it to, say, MITRE's attack framework, which was something that was mattering more and more to our customers. And because we were an attack framework, it was more about how do we measure the capabilities of those security technologies. So it wasn't just about the configuration issues. You take X, Y, and Z technology and you say, well, I've bought that technology because of this particular capability that it offers our organization. And now you can test for it. And so it's really a black and white answer at the end of the day. You have a technology, it offers a capability, you go and validate that capability. It's either there or it's not. If it's not there, you either have misconfigured something or the salesperson at that vendor has actually completely lied to you and it was never there in the first place. And if it is there, then that's a strength that you have and an area that's viewed as not a gap in the MITRE attack matrix.
It's funny that you mentioned this because, you know, like we had this conversation privately in less elegant terms where you said basically business really took off when you wiped away like 80% of your UI and just simplified it down to this thing. And I think that's, you know, it's great to see companies being rewarded for that because I think we do have a tendency to overcomplicate things. And I see it particularly from security technologies that have been created by consultants. I think it's a common trap.
Yeah. I mean, again, it goes back to learning from our customers. Early on, AttackIQ had some fantastic customers that, you know, today
the power users, right? But they're not going to make your business fly, right?
Yeah, but they're the ones who speak loudly, represent, you know, the industry, go and speak at conferences, and are representative really of not just the more sophisticated types of users, but all of the users in that particular industry.
Mm. But I mean, was that a fair characterization that when you simplified it took off?
Absolutely. I mean, we had to simplify it. And so today, you know, when we go talk to industries and we talk about how MITRE's attack matrix has been something that we're very focused on, we also talk about that we can certainly map to NIST and NASCAR and the DoD standard and other types of frameworks, but MITRE is what our focus is on. And it's because if you do something and you focus on it, you must do it well, it's going to, at the end of the day, really resonate with your clients.
Now, you mentioned before that you were talking to MITRE about, and kind of, talking to them about the framework and maybe some changes afoot. Like, are they easy to work with on this sort of thing? Do you feel that, like, because it is already a great bit of work, but do you feel like it's something that's going to stay relevant and adapt?
I mean, it's only been picking up steam, right? So MITRE's attack matrix was actually introduced about the same time Attack IQ was, about 5 years ago, and it's only been gaining in traction and popularity. And so this is something that obviously we're huge proponents of. Attack IQ actually got put on the voting charter to help introduce new techniques, new tactics. So one of the things we're pushing in the matrix is actually taking into account attacks, within kind of the cloud infrastructure, within ICS. You know, a few years ago, I spoke with one of the utilities companies talking about, attacking RTUs and rogue DNP3 packets being sent off. And so there's more attacks based off the infrastructure, based off the industry that can be introduced. So this is something that's going to constantly evolve. But finally, we have a framework that's looking at it from the adversarial perspective versus just the defensive perspective. And so now I think that we're on the right side of the fence. When we introduce a new security technology and control, we map it to what are the adversaries, tactics, techniques, and procedures. And that's a winning strategy in my perspective.
Cloud security is a mess though, right? Like I can see why, because it's just so different. I don't think people have necessarily wrapped their heads around just quite how different it is. I had a very brief chat with Rich Mogul, veteran analyst, very smart guy. He's founded a startup. Forgive me, I can't remember the name of it, but he's doing cloud-based security stuff. And he's just like, man, it is so different and people haven't wrapped their heads around it. And I guess that's, how do you even simulate what a unique to cloud environment attack looks like? Seriously, yeah. How do you do that?
I mean, you go back to some of the very basics. I mean, how many times have we seen, insecure S3 buckets? Very basic type of validation test to start running. And so it's what are the technologies that exist within the clouds, insecure VPC connections, we start looking at the very, 10 top basic aspects within the cloud security, and then you can get much more complex. But some of our cloud customers have actually started introducing their own scenarios and then sharing it, whether they're an AWS customer or they're a Google Cloud customer.
But I mean, how do you even try to detect a rogue Lambda routine? Like that stuff is mind warping.
Yeah, again, but we're not doing the detection, right? We're actually creating that scenario in order to see, are there defensive preventative or detection controls in place to alert the security team of those anomalies?
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting at. I mean, do you even have any detection controls to validate against for things like that?
So there's more and more, vendors coming out and jumping, and as they do, now there's a way to test. But this is something that's going to constantly evolve, right? And so we're looking at like the energy and utilities, which are on much older type of technologies and operating systems, and then we look at kind of the evolution of the maturity of your security infrastructure towards kind of completely ephemeral type of instances that are popping up and there for milliseconds, doing some compute and then popping down. And the idea of security in and around that is completely different. So I think that's something that we're paying attention to. As that becomes a need, we'll have those proper scenarios in place. But there's still so much to do with the kind of more legacy type infrastructure and the more typical type of security controls.
Try not to get bogged down in the exotic stuff when there's plenty to do, right? Plenty of bread and butter
focus,
left, right?
focus.
Yeah. All right, Steph and Jeanette, thank you very much for joining us on this Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast to talk about, what's been going on with Attack IQ and, quite a bit of detail about the attack matrix there, the MITRE attack matrix. It's been very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Stefan Chanet of Attack IQ there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can find Attack IQ's stuff at attackiq.com. Big thanks to Attack IQ for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. I'll be back in a few days with the next weekly show. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.